I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a collection of short stories featuring Indian American characters crafted in three full dimensions, in defiance of the stereotypes foisted on them by the rest of the country. Writer Neil Patel will be my guest this hour. He grew up in the small city of Champaign, Illinois, the son of immigrant parents. Wishing to please his parents, but recognizing that he preferred partying to studying, he was gay, and he wanted to write rather than pursue something like a medical degree. Patel also had to cope with racism and ignorance from classmates and teachers alike, and he's given his characters similar challenges in stories that are funny, maddening, and sometimes heartbreaking. Our conversation starts after a short break. Even if you don't hold the common stereotypes about Indian Americans, you might be aware of them. They're supposed to be universally gifted students and obedient sons and daughters eagerly marching off to law school or medical school. And often when they appear as characters in popular culture, at least as characters written by white creators, Indian Americans are shy or awkward or somehow oddly sexless. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Writer Neil Patel does something interesting with those assumptions in his new collection of short stories. He acknowledges them and then he shatters them by crafting his Indian American characters in all their dimensions, revealing complete human beings full of passion and seasoned by strengths and by flaws. His stories remind us of the ways that the Indian American experience is shaped by the influence of that community and also by interactions with a broader culture that relies all too often on assumptions that are not accurate. Neil Patel's book is called If You See Me, Don't Say Hi. He joins us from the studios of NPR West. Neil, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
So this book is so interesting because you turn stereotypes inside out multiple times here. So we meet plenty of characters who break the mold of what's seen to be the ideal Indian American. But it is safe to say this book contains maybe more references to medical school than the average short story collection. So Do you have to somehow acknowledge the stereotypes that exist in order to start breaking them down?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was aware of these stereotypes, you know, from a young age. And the thing about stereotypes is it's not that they're untrue, it's that they're incomplete. Mm-hmm. And they don't paint an accurate portrait of a person. And I was aware of, you know, the way Indians were represented on TV or even sometimes in literature. And it seemed very incomplete. And I definitely didn't kind of fit the mold in terms of what an ideal Indian American is. And so I wanted to kind of tell my story. So that's what I did.
Were your parents always fine with the fact that you didn't fit the mold?
No. No. And actually, I'm thankful that they're in Europe right now. I can't hear this. No, you know, it wasn't their fault. You know, I think immigrant parents, I think it's a terrifying thing to raise children in a foreign country. Yeah. And I think a lot of immigrant parents, they raise their kids according to a set of standards. And usually those standards are set by, you know, what other people in their community are doing. And so, yeah, there were a number of kids that I grew up around who were, you know, brilliant math students and really good at science and winning, you know, science fairs and getting perfect SAT scores. And so I was aware that my parents kind of were concerned that it wasn't that I was a poor student. It was that I was an average student. And I don't think you get to be average, you know, in my generation as an Indian American. So, yeah, they were concerned a little bit.
The story, Hari Rama, Hari Krishna, is fascinating on multiple levels. First of all, the narrator's father is this sort of on-again, off-again, unfaithful husband, like he leaves the family and then he comes back. It's interesting because usually the narratives we get about this sort of, the effect of this sort of activity within a family and in a marriage, something big happens and then it's forever different. And in this case, it's sort of in limbo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think a lot of that has to do with duty and obligation, and this man was sort of, they had an arranged marriage, and you know, I think he kept coming back because he felt this sense of duty to his family, and yet, you know, he sort of, you know, maybe he didn't want to marry her, and maybe he had his own dreams and ambitions and desires. But unfortunately, I think especially in my parents' generation, you don't always get to chase those desires and dreams, and you're kind of bound by familial duty. And I think that's what kept bringing him back.
Are Indian American parents starting to arrange marriages for gay and lesbian sons and daughters?
Not that I know of. That would actually be a good thing, I think, because I think it's really hard to find someone being gay. I haven't really heard of it, but, you know, maybe my generation will start to do that. Yeah.
So in that story, Hari Rama, Hari Krishna, the narrator is, so he has this situation with his parents. He's also trying to navigate these really complicated relationships at school and in his love life. This is the background at home. It's interesting because he's a gay teenage boy who is bullied at school, and there's this kind of dangerous undercurrent in realizing he has a crush on a boy, Jordan. Mm-hmm. But the way you write about his realization that maybe Jordan likes him back, it took me straight back to high school. That is a universal emotion.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, high school is a tricky time. Mm. I always say, like, who you are in high school is who you are in life. You just get better at hiding it. So, you know, I think, like, the insecure, unsure people will always be insecure and unsure, no matter how beautiful or successful they may become. It's a really tricky time. And, I think we all can relate to sort of having crushes on people and not being able to express those feelings and sort of being devastated by that.
His mother, meanwhile, sort of telegraphs the state of her heart with what she cooks and how she cooks.
Yeah. Yeah. Cooking was a big part of my household. You know, my mother cooked all the time, and she is a great cook. And, you know, she learned from her mother, who learned from her mother. And I think sometimes, you know, cooking is a sense of control. Like, you know, when you can't control certain elements of your life, you can control what you put on a plate and serve to someone. And I think that was her way of dealing with things.
I felt for her because she's in this unenviable position. I mean, maybe she didn't want to marry her husband either, but this is, you know, the sort of her lot in life. She can literally observe what he's up to just by looking out the window, because he's just decided to kind of move a couple doors down after they temporarily separate.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel for her too, because I think often, especially in the Indian community, especially with people my parents' generation, women didn't really get a voice, and they didn't really, they were sort of married off to men. And, you know, you especially coming to another country, you don't really have a sense of agency when you sort of follow your husband to America. And, you know, he becomes this doctor or businessman or engineer, and you don't really have your own identity. And, I know with my mom, she came from London, and she moved to America with my dad, and he brought her to Champaign, Illinois, which is a small university town, and she hated it because she used to live in London. And when she was in London, she had her own life. You know, she used to go to rock concerts, and she had a job, and she had a car, and she had certain freedoms because she was the youngest in her family. And then all of that changed when she came to America. And I do think it put a strain on the relationship early on.
Yeah, I happened to look it up. And Champaign, Illinois, even today, has a population of, like, I don't know, 86,000 or something. It's a pretty small city.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is. When I was a child in Champaign, Illinois, it's different now. But back then, people didn't really even know what an Indian was. And I remember my mother telling me that some of the neighborhood women would introduce her to people, and they'd say, "Oh, and she speaks English, and she speaks so well." And, you know, my mother before even living in London, she was born in Tanzania, which is was a British colony, and she went to a convent school where, you know, English was the language they spoke. So I remember her, you know, getting annoyed by that. And even in school, you know, people thought I was Native American. Kids would ask me if I lived on a reservation. And a lot of that kind of informed, you know, the material in the book as well.
Yeah, often, you know, your characters find themselves in spaces where there aren't a lot of people who look like them or who come from similar backgrounds. And mm-hmm. school is like the first place, I guess, where you realize, oh, I'm going to be othered here. Mm-hmm. I'm just another 5-year-old showing up for kindergarten. But for reasons I can't understand, people treat me like there's something different about me.
Yeah, yeah. I felt that all the time in school. You know, it's... And I didn't really think about it at the time, but now, you know, I'm 35, and now when I think about what it was like for me to walk into a classroom and everybody is different, you know, from me, or I'm the only one who's different. And it's interesting because I actually did a signing event at the Barnes & Noble in my hometown a few weeks ago, and one of my kindergarten teachers showed up, and I didn't really remember her, but she remembered me, and later I was thinking, well, I guess she would remember me because I think I was the only Indian kid she had. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's an interesting experience when you look around and, you know, you're the odd one out.
Yeah. And we see teachers here and you can sort of see it happening, right? They're thinking, oh, this will be great for the class if we ask you to do a special report on something. Mm-hmm. And you feel like no one else is asked to do a report on like Christmas or Hanukkah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You kind of become a mascot, you know, for your community and your culture. And yeah, I remember when we learned about Hinduism, I felt very awkward about it because our religion is so bizarre to somebody who's, you know, not used to it.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from the depictions of, you know, multi-armed gods and, you know, like there's a, you know, we have Ganesh, who is like an elephant god, and you know, blue skin and all these things. And most of the kids in my class were Christian. And I know I had a lot of people kind of come up to me and say that I was going to go to hell, or maybe they should save me, and maybe I should go to their church. And it was a very awkward time to be in, so...
Well, it's interesting because with all due respect to people of all different faiths, they all sound... odd if they're not mm-hmm. your tradition, right? If you weren't raised mm-hmm. with it, the things that you just believe or take as a matter of course sound pretty peculiar in almost every different belief system.
Yeah, yeah. I think for me the difference was just a very little was known about Hinduism. You know, when I was growing up, it's sort of and I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, especially in this country, we Indian people tend to keep to themselves. We're very kind of insulated in this community, and I think a lot of that has to do with fear, and fear of being judged, and fear of not being accepted. And you know, you'll find, you know, whether it's a college campus or a bar or you know, a neighborhood somewhere, Indians are kind of all like linked up together, and. Very little was known about our culture. And I think that made at least me a little bit afraid. So,
and I wonder what the relationships are like for you as a person born in the U.S. Do you feel you mm-hmm. have a lot in common with someone who's your age, but maybe didn't arrive in the U.S. until adulthood?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point because, you know, there's such a division between Indians who are born and raised in America and Indians who have come from India. And I know when I went to the University of Illinois, and there was such a division because we had an Indian Student Association, but it was comprised mostly of, you know, Indians who were born here. And so we had very little interaction with them.
My guest is author Neil Patel. We're talking about his short story collection, If You See Me, Don't Say Hi. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We're at @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Neil Patel. His short story collection is called If You See Me, Don't Say Hi. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Neil, before the break, you were talking about a certain insularity within the Indian American community, which makes perfect sense that if everybody in the broader culture treats you like you are exotic or different in some way, you're drawn to hang out with people who understand kind of your full humanity. I was really interested then in the two stories that are linked in this collection, World Famous and Radhakrishna. We see that there are consequences to being in this in-group that protects and nurtures its own if you violate certain taboos. So the character of Anjali, who appears in both stories, is punished by the community for divorcing her husband when she learns he's gay.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of wrote those stories with the community in mind, and it was sort of my way of chastising the community a bit. It can be a very nurturing community, of course, but it can also be very cruel, like all communities can be. You know, I think society is cruel, and I think when you stray from the norm, you know, there are certain consequences. And so I had this character in mind, Anjali, who, you know, she doesn't necessarily come from the ideal Indian American family, in the sense that, you know, her father isn't a doctor. They don't have much money, and you know, she's a woman, and I think that people tend to in this situation, she was in the story, she was married to somebody who, you know, turned out to be gay, but of course his parents refused to accept that he was gay, and instead they twisted the narrative and turned it around on her and blamed her. And, you know, in these situations, I think people tend to believe the family who has the power, you know, who has the money. And I really felt for her.
Yeah, I thought you did such an effective job at exploring class consciousness within the Indian American community here, because there are, like, the families headed by professional parents, doctors and lawyers and professors, and then there are the ones like Anjali's family who get by running motels, and there are a couple of those within this book. Both kinds of parents are part of these Indian communities in their cities, and both are sort of expected to produce children who do amazingly well and get these lucrative jobs, but they have different sort of circumstances working for and against them.
Oh yeah. You know, and it's interesting. You know, I know so many people who, you know, their parents own motels, and they really encourage their children to become doctors. And, you know, doctors in general, I think, you know, no matter who you are in America, we all have certain ideas about doctors that, you know, you must be smart. It's a noble profession, and it's a lucrative profession. And, you know, Indians are very status conscious people. You know, they're, I would say, wealth obsessed, especially people from my parents' generation. And the thing about immigration is, you know, most immigrants don't come to America to be poor. You know, there's a certain level of expectation. You know, especially with Indians, you know, Indians come to America to do well. And they pass that sense of expectation down to their children. And it's expected that their children should do well. And their children's success sort of mirrors their own. And that creates an enormous amount of pressure, you know, on a child to know that if you are unsuccessful, then your parents' sacrifice was in vain.
So sometimes the families, the parents in these families in your book and all these stories, clearly they've experienced discrimination themselves. Their mm-hmm. defense is sometimes to look at white Americans as kind of weak and soft. And I laughed when the mother in World Famous says, these whites are always depressed.
Yeah.
But I realized what a powerful passage that was, because wrapped within that is a kind of instruction, right? We are not the kind of people who get depressed. You, she's saying to her son, cannot get depressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I think it has to do with where you come from and I think your background. You know, my parents did not grow up with a lot. You know, my dad, he's of Indian origin, but he grew up in Kenya. And, you know, his father was a conductor on the railroad. And he, you know, to that generation, you know, mental health and things like therapy, it's kind of self-indulgent, you know? The idea of sitting in a therapist's office and talking about yourself, it seems a bit self-indulgent to them. And I think they think of that as, yeah, you know, white people problems. So... you know, mental health is a real, you know, I know so many Indian kids my age who would have wanted to go to therapy or needed some kind of therapy. I mean, you can't grow up in a country that doesn't always feel like your own and be othered by so many people and not need help, mm-hmm. you know, and especially to have all this expectation from your parents, and then your parents don't understand you and they don't understand what's going on with you every day at school. You know, you need help. And it's interesting because, you know, Indian Americans, we're just like everyone else. And I know a lot of Indians who, you know, they turn to alcohol, they turn to drugs, they turn to all these other things except for, you know, therapy or something like that.
So some of your characters who are gay have this kind of alternative challenge at home. More than once, you give us mothers who say to their sons, what kind of boy behaves this way? Meaning, what kind of boy is interested in clothes or dancing or whatever it might be? Mm-hmm. It's like there is not room for them to be queer. It's not like the mothers are saying, I wonder if my son is gay. It's almost like, mm-hmm. I don't understand what's wrong with you because I can't think of what the possibility could be that causes you to behave in these ways.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think that generation of people, they didn't even really, I think that's another thing, being gay is seen as like an American thing, you know, to some foreigners, like uh-huh. that's an American thing, that's a white American thing, you know, our people don't do that, you know, we're not gay. Yeah, so I think they're very blinded and they instead see a child who's doing something that is socially unacceptable. And so, you know, they try to correct that behavior without actually wondering what's causing it.
There's one mother in the book that you describe as eventually sort of taking off her blinders or no longer pretending she was blind to the truth. And that's a really interesting way to phrase it.
Yeah. Which story was that?
Forgive me. I think that's Hari Rama, Hari Krishna.
Okay, yeah, yeah. That's what I thought. It's funny because I wrote this book so long ago, so sometimes I forget. Uh-huh. Yeah, you know, in the end, she accepts it and she realizes. But I also think part of that was in this story, I think the mother was so wrapped up in her own issues, you know, mm-hmm. her philandering husband and her own sense of isolation. And I think sometimes as children, we forget that our parents have their own issues.
Right.
You know? And I think as a child, you think you're the center of the universe and you forget that your parents had a past, you know, they have a present and they have a future that they're thinking about. So I think, you know, she finally kind of realized, you know, what the situation was.
Did you have to come out to your parents as gay and also as wanting to be a writer?
I came out as wanting to be a writer. Being gay is something we just don't really discuss, and it's mostly my issue. And I've had conversations with other gay men about this. You know, the whole concept of coming out to me is just, it's kind of ridiculous in a way, because it's like, are you supposed to just like send a newsletter to people? are you supposed to call people? And, you know, like with my friends, you know, most of them knew anyway. They mm-hmm. just never said anything. And even that, me having to come out, to, it was a very awkward thing. And I think it's unfortunate that we have to come out, period, because it's unfortunate that we didn't grow up in a society where it was just known and accepted that, mm-hmm. you know, some people, you know, like women, some people like men, some people like both, some, you know, and so it's something that I don't have anyone in my life that I would want to bring home to my family. And other than that, it's just sex. And I don't think anyone wants to talk about their sex lives with their parents. So, yeah, but as a writer, yes, I had to tell them that I wanted to be a writer and that I felt that I could be a writer. And it wasn't so bad. You know, actually, it's interesting. My dad, he's a doctor, but he had dreams of being a movie producer. And this was back when he was living in Kenya. And, you know, he had those dreams. But in his generation, it was definitely unacceptable to dare to dream of being a movie producer. So it wasn't so bad. But of course, they were concerned. And beyond their concerns, it's, well, what will other people say?
Hmm.
And there were a number of people, a number of Indian uncles and aunties who kind of like made snide remarks. And, you know, you could kind of see the joy in their face, you know, to know that, you know, Dr. Patel's son wasn't going to be another doctor, you know. Now it's a different story.
Because you've got this book out?
Yeah, because I have this book out and there are a few other opportunities that are kind of opening up for me. And my parents are very proud and very excited. And a lot of people, you know, are really excited. What I really love is how many people my age, Indian kids who are born in this country, are just saying, like, it's so nice to see someone do something different and, you know, succeed at it. And that really means a lot to me to hear that.
My guest is writer Neil Patel. We're talking about his short story collection, If You See Me, Don't Say Hi. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's go to the phones now. We have Scott on the line in Coppell. Hi, Scott.
Okay. Hi, I'm Mr. Patel. My question is, you know, I know several Indian couples or families who, and they've told me outright their marriages are arranged. I also know mm-hmm. Several Christian families, friends whose marriages are not arranged. So can you comment on that? What is your feeling about the success of arranged marriages versus non-arranged marriage?
Thanks for
calling. Okay. That's a good question. Yeah, you know, I think sometimes it has to do with choice. And, you know, arranged marriages, at least in my parents' generation, are generally successful because there wasn't really much choice. And I think our parents didn't grow up with all of these choices. So they learned to make do with what they had and make something work. I think the problem with our generation is we have so many choices and we have so many options and we don't feel bound by anything. So whenever there's a problem, you know, I think sometimes it's easier to bail than to make it work. And I think that could be, because I think there was a statistic I read somewhere that arranged marriages tend to be more successful. But it also could be that in arranged marriages, people don't feel they have the choice to leave. So they're bound by it. So, yeah, it's a tricky situation.
So in a couple of different stories, white characters are described by the color of their skin. And it's typically when the white characters are pretty horrible people. So the bully in Hari Rama Hari Krishna has skin the color of a boiled shrimp. Somebody in another story has skin like a boiled tomato. Or later it's pink and it shines like a scab. And what's so interesting to me about that was that I noticed it because it made me think of how seldom white writers even allude to differences in white skin color, because white is treated as the default. And of course, if you're a person of color, you're going to notice the variations in white skin that we pretend don't exist.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, the yeah, I mean, we People of color are very conscious of their skin color. And I think you're right. You know, I think white people aren't always conscious unless, you know, they want to get tan and, you know, but yeah, I know at least for people of color, we're very sort of skin color conscious, and we know all the different shades of brown because some of us don't want to be that shade of brown and some of us want to be lighter. And there's this, especially in the Indian community, there is this preoccupation with being fair skinned. And, you know, a lot, I know my mom used to get mad if my sister, you know, would be out in the sun too long and she'd get dark. And yeah, we're very conscious of the shade of our skin.
The story that is your title story, If You See Me, Don't Say Hi, it takes all the themes in this book, I think, and puts them into this single gut-wrenching story. There are these two brothers. For a long time, the older one is the cool one. He's the one who kind of stands out, and he's got all the girlfriends. And then it reverses, just sort of based on the trajectory of their careers and some other things. The moment the younger brother dares to say out loud what he thinks about his brother, everything changes. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me when you said that you just don't talk with your parents about being gay. Like, it seems mm-hmm. like this story is really about all the things that everybody thinks but isn't able to say.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, the story was, yeah, you know, I think I can only speak for, you know, Indians, but yeah, there's so much that's not said, that's unsaid. A part of it is, you know, out of respect. You know, you're supposed to respect your older brother. You're supposed to respect your elders, your parents, your grandparents, your uncles and aunties. And, you know, sometimes sometimes you have to earn that respect, you know? And just because you're my uncle, why should I respect you if you're talking down to me, you know? And I think in this particular story, this younger brother could see all of his brother's flaws, and he saw what he was doing, and he didn't agree with it. But being the younger brother, he was not able to voice those opinions until he reached a breaking point and it all kind of came out.
My guest is author Neil Patel. His short story collection is called If You See Me, Don't Say Hi. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERATHINK. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Neil Patel about his short story collection, If You See Me, Don't Say Hi. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. So, Neil, sometimes writers will talk about the challenges, but also the pleasures and liberations of writing from the perspective of somebody who's female, if they're male, or male, if they're female. Does that compare in any significant way to switching between characters who are gay or straight?
Yeah, you know, I enjoyed writing from both perspectives. I grew up around, you know, so many straight people, straight men, straight women. So naturally, sort of, I felt connected to them, and I wanted to tell their stories as well as my own. And particularly straight men, you know, I never had a brother. I have an older sister, and I think sometimes when I was writing this book, I felt I was able to kind of live vicariously and imagine, especially in the title story, you know, that I had a brother. So, yeah, I have really enjoyed writing from different perspectives.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Sarah on the line in Westlake. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well.
Thank you so much, Neil, for sharing your stories. It means a lot to me, especially I'm a pansexual writer of color, Muslim. And okay. I just had a question about writing these narratives, because in the age of cultural relativism that we live in, how do you portray these stories without feeding into the narrative that's often created by privileged white individuals who are saying that people from our region of the world are uncivilized because of how we treat the LGBT community, when it is an issue that we have within our own communities that we're trying to work on. So I guess my question is, how do you rephrase those stories so that they're not used against us?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know how. I think, you know, I think the best thing you can do as a writer of color, as a writer who is queer, as any kind of writer, is to just tell your own stories and to tell the truth. And I think for me, I was just aware of the narratives that were out there that were controlled by other people. And I wanted to tell my story and my experience. And I didn't really think about anything else. I didn't think about how the story was going to be received. I didn't think about what people were going to think. I just thought about how I felt at the time, you know, as a child, as a young adult, and I wrote through that.
Another really interesting story here is Just a Friend. So in this case, mm-hmm. your character is a young, I think, white man named John who meets this interesting, somewhat older Indian American at a bar. That character, Ashwin, is keeping his sexual orientation a secret, and we're led to believe that he can only have this affair with John because his wife is out of town. I won't spoil it. It turns out to be vastly more complicated than that. But can you talk about what made you want to sort of explore Ashwin's secrets?
Yeah. I wanted to write this story. You know, this is the one story in the collection where the narrator is actually not Indian. And I wanted to kind of flip it and think about what it must be like to be involved with someone from a vastly different culture who has sort of all these limitations and who can't fully open up to you and be with you. And in a way, I was able to kind of write about what it's like to be Indian and gay and have all these secrets through the character of a sort of more accepted white person who probably, you know, his sexuality was an easier thing to come out of the closet for him. As the story developed, and again, I don't want to give it away, but I realized that things weren't as they seemed.
When you grow up in a place like Champaign, Illinois, how big is the Indian American community there?
You know, now it's actually pretty significant because, the university is attracting people, there are many more job opportunities for Indians there. But when I grew up, it was really small, actually. I think we pretty much knew all the Indian people who were living in Champaign, Illinois. And I was born in 82. And this is probably from 82 right up until I graduated high school, 2000. It wasn't a very big... But, you know, you'll find in America there are these pockets of Indian communities in small towns. And it's interesting. I had a conversation with somebody and I was telling them about all about my experience growing up in this small town as Indian. And she was like, well, why would your parents do that to you? You know? And I don't think my parents were thinking about that at all. I think, you know, Indians, again, they go where the opportunity is and where the money is. And my father was thinking, well, I'll do really well in Champaign, Illinois. And he did. But the consequence was he had a son who was completely, you know, adrift and othered at school. So
so you mentioned that your mother spent some time in childhood in Tanzania, and I think you said your mm-hmm. dad was in Kenya. The mm-hmm. story, The Other Language, takes this mm-hmm. Indian-American family to their parents, the place where their parents had grown up, which I think is mm-hmm. Kenya in the story. Mm-hmm. It's so interesting because it's a mixing of cultures, and suddenly, as an Indian-American, these individuals find themselves in this privileged position.
Yes. You know, there is a significant Indian population in East Africa, which is due to British colonialism. You know, the British occupied India as well as East Africa, so a lot of Indians kind of migrated to East Africa, and You know, the Indians in Kenya, you know, they did very well. And it created this kind of rift. And I feel that, you know, with Indian Americans, I think they were given certain, with Indians in Kenya, they were given certain privileges that Black Africans didn't necessarily have. And that created this kind of rift between them. And I know that when I was growing up, I used to constantly hear stories about what it was like in Nairobi for, you know, these wealthy Indians and how it wasn't safe for them. And but then when I went there, you know, and I saw kind of the way the Indian people in Kenya kind of treated the people who worked for them, there was this air of superiority, you know. And I was very inspired by that, and I wanted to kind of write a story that took place there.
It's really heartbreaking because the character who's the narrator, first of all, he opens the story with a line that just draws you in right away, which is, sometimes at night I heard my parents complaining about me in the kitchen, arguing over which one of them had failed. So we're already kind of invested in this character, but we discover that due to a mistake, but like a kind of arrogant mistake, he has an effect he never meant to have on someone's life. And by the time he discovers this, it's way too late to do anything about it.
Yeah. And that mistake is really evidence of his own sense of privilege. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the idea that he can fix something, you know, because he is in a position to do so. Yeah, that story was really difficult to write. It took many drafts and many different endings, and ultimately, yeah, it's a story. It really is a story about privilege, you know, when you think about it.
How did it change along the way?
I think it went from being, I can't remember what the original ending was. And I don't want to give anything away, so it's like kind of a little bit difficult to answer this question. But I think what happened was, as I got to know the characters more with each draft and know the story more, I realized what the story really was about. You know, yes, it's about, you know, it's a coming of age story. Yes, it's a gay story. It's a love story. But it really, to me, was a story about class, social class, and class privilege. And a lot of the collection kind of is informed by that. You know, social class, especially where I grew up, growing up in the Midwest, you're very aware of social class in a way that I don't feel like I'm as aware of it here in LA, because I think in the Midwest, in the town that I grew up in Champaign, you know, you can be of one social class and you're in a classroom with people who are completely different from you. You know, you live maybe a mile away from someone who has a completely different experience from you. Whereas now I live in LA, and, you know, that's not possible. You know, if you live in a wealthy area, you're sort of buffered and, you know, no one can even penetrate that neighborhood. So, yeah, that was sort of what I was thinking about when I was trying to finish the story.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So, Neil, it sounds like maybe you've become aware of your sense of being different from the, and excuse the expression and please understand it in context, the mm-hmm. motel running Indians that were maybe part of the Indian community in Champaign.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I was actually always kind of aware of knowing that my father was a doctor and what that meant, not just in the Indian community, but in all communities. And, you know, I paid attention, you know, when my father would, you know, we'd be at like Walmart or something, and like a former patient of my dad's would come and like kind of like shake his hand and say, "Oh, Dr. Patel," and, you know, "Oh, doc this or doc that." And there was this level of respect that they had for my father. And it was even more so, you know, in the Indian community, you know, I could see how there was so much respect for my father for being a doctor. And again, like I had said earlier, you know, so many of our friends who own motels, who also did well, you know, but they wanted their children to be doctors. And that showed that they had this sort of awe of the medical profession and what that means for you and what that can get you in life. I'm very, very aware of it.
Did you try to want that? Did you try to want to be a doctor?
Very briefly. I think for me, because it was all I knew, I wasn't very impressed by it. Mm-hmm. And I'm still not. It's funny because all my friends are doctors, almost all, you know, about 95% of my friends are doctors. And, you know, it's a great field. But I didn't really grow up that way thinking, wow, I'm in awe of this. Instead, I was thinking, I want to be a movie producer. I want to be, you know, I want to do something different and something big. You know, not that that's not big. I don't want to offend any of my friends or family. But yeah, I didn't. It was very brief. And it was only because I felt that that's what I was supposed to do.
Do you mind if I ask what your sister does?
Yeah, no, she my sister has a master's in epidemiology. And she's now a housewife. She has three children, and her husband is an orthopedic surgeon. And I always make fun of her because I said, because she was actually going to go to med school. And I said, oh, I guess instead of going to med school, you married a doctor.
How do you make decisions with short stories about what needs to be in any given sentence or paragraph and what you can leave out or have to leave out?
Yeah, you know, it's such a challenge writing short stories. Most writers will tell you that writing short stories is way more challenging than writing a novel, because the thing about a short story is it's such a you know, it's such a every sentence counts, mm-hmm. you know, every word counts, you know, every placement counts, because it's sort of magnified simply because it's short. It's a short piece. So, you know, I think a lot about everything I say in a short story, and I go over it and I go over it. And you know, writing, as they say, is rewriting. So most of the work is in revising it. And it can take, I can write a story probably in 2 days, but it'll take me months to revise it.
So my grandmother taught me to crochet when I was a little girl, and mm-hmm. She taught me to make these squares, and then at the end mm-hmm. you'd put them all together and make a blanket. And yeah. you can tell yeah. the difference between the first one that I made and the one that I made right before they were all going to be sewn together. Do you feel that way about these stories?
Yeah, I can see the growth, you know, in the collection. I actually had a conversation with a writer. Her name is Mira Jacob, and she was saying, you know, you start a book as one writer and you end it as another. And I totally agree with that, and I feel the same way about my book. You know, the first story I wrote was These Things Happen. The last story I wrote was Radha Krishna at the end, and I can see the growth. You know, I felt that in the collection, I became a writer, you know, and yeah, you know, the progression, you know, even If You See Me, Don't Say Hi, with the title story, that was sort of one of the final stories that I wrote. And I felt that each story got me closer and closer to the core of who I am as a writer and what I have to say and what I wanted to talk about.
Author Neil Patel's short story collection is called If You See Me, Don't Say Hi. Neil, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for making time to speak with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. We have Eric Bright on the board for us today. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. Never miss an episode of Think by subscribing to the podcast using any podcast app you like. And leave us a review if you are so inclined. You can check out future episodes of the show, what we're planning, and who works on the show at our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.